is not here today. She is thank you. Director of Analytic of the Division of Analytic Chemistry at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. She has been one of the key leaders within the APHL in thinking about biomonitoring and has headed up both the planning group for the National Biomonitoring Meeting as well as the work group that is putting together the guidance for laboratories on establishing biomonitoring programs within their laboratories. She is fabulous, funny, great, and then we're just very sad that she's not here today. So we're going to pretend that Megan is, and we're going to cut her a little slack since she's using someone else's slides. So go for it.
All right. So Julia's here to talk to you about, so you want to do biomonitoring. And the point of the next three presentations are really, what do you need? You know, what do you need to think about if you're going to do biomonitoring? Because there is a lot to think about. And so she's going to talk about it from the laboratory perspective. So first off, she's starting just by saying biomonitoring can help answer important environmental health questions. Hopefully you're all on board with that one. If not, talk to me afterwards. But so there's three sort of main areas of types of biomonitoring studies. The first is targeted, the second is surveillance, and the third is public health policy, according to Julie. So for targeted efforts, I actually am going to go a little bit off Julie's talking points, because later when she gets into the weeds of laboratory stuff, I'm not going to be able to do that. So I'm going to tell you some examples in Massachusetts and in Julie's state of these types of studies. So targeted efforts, let's see, an ongoing community concern. So there was a middle school student in Massachusetts a couple of years ago who must have gone up to his attic or somehow found some old mercury lying around. And for anybody who used to play with mercury as a child, it's pretty cool stuff. So he brought it to school to show all of his friends and hauled it all over the school, all around, all day, opened it up. And by the time the administration found out, a lot of people were potentially exposed. So the Massachusetts Department of Public Health went in, the hazmat team went in and started to clean up. I mean, because it had actually, it was, you know, it had spilled in several places. And the Department of Public Health went in and started to do some air sampling. And they found it pretty much all over the school, including the place where they went when they evacuated the school. So parents, needless to say, were beside themselves with worry. You know, was my children exposed to high levels of mercury? Because I think at this point, pretty much everybody knows exposure to mercury is not a great thing. So the Department of Public Health called the laboratory and said, hey, you guys can do this. We know you can do this. We're going to get some blood samples for you, or urine. I forget. I think they did urine. It makes more sense to do urine for inorganic. So they pulled some samples on 30 students plus some families, the family of the child who brought it in. And for the most part, they were able to say, you know what, there's no worry here. You're fine. And I think that's a really important point, because a lot of times you hear politicians saying, I don't want to do biomonitoring. I have enough problems to deal with. You know, God forbid we find something. Well, biomonitoring isn't just about finding problems. It can actually help to calm people's fears. And in this case, that's exactly what it did. The second bullet under targeted efforts is emergency response. And Massachusetts also has a very interesting story regarding emergency response. This year, I think it was, or maybe it was last year, might have been 2010, a fisherman shows up at a local hospital with bright yellow blisters all over his arm. And he says, yeah, we were out clamming this morning, and we dug up this thing that looked like a torpedo, and it was leaking. And we just threw it back in and didn't think anything of it. And then 4 hours later, he has a lot of other, I forget what the symptoms were, shortness of breath, some heart problems. So the hospital immediately calls Poison Control Center, calls the health department, and luckily Massachusetts is part of CDC's Laboratory Response Network, which is a A network that was originally built to respond to terrorism events and chemicals of weapons of mass destruction. And so they immediately thought, this is a blister agent. This is a weapon of mass destruction. And then a second guy shows up at the hospital, and he was on the same boat. And he is feeling like he has some symptoms. So the laboratory was able to run the tests for sulfur mustard, and actually found that the first guy was exposed to sulfur mustard. He had a metabolite of sulfur mustard in his system. And he was effectively treated. The second guy was just one of the worried well, didn't have any exposure. But then, you know, not only was it good that we were able to calm the second guy down, you know, that he was not exposed, we knew how to treat the first guy. But this also opened up a whole question of, what do you do with all the clams that were on the boat that might have been exposed? I mean, they were all pulled up in the same net as this torpedo. So there were a lot of hundreds of thousands of clams. And Massachusetts said, well, you can't dispose of chemical weapons in our state. Luckily, Texas and Arkansas said, oh, we'll take them, we'll incinerate them. So that wasn't a problem, I guess. Well, it depends on where you live. Maybe not a problem in Massachusetts, but maybe Texas and Arkansas. So anyway, so those are some examples of targeted efforts. And then Julie had actually prepared some slides to talk about a case study. But before I go into that, she also wanted to highlight how important collaboration is. And you've heard me say this already, but, you know, it's truly, you know, you need the health department on board, you need clinicians, you need the community epidemiologists, toxicologists. Sometimes you have the environmental agencies, the Poison Control Center, academics, law enforcement, and agricultural agencies. So her case study is about a USGS project, the United States Geological Service. And what they were doing is they were trying to find the homes that were at the greatest risk of arsenic and uranium in their drinking water based on geology. And so they went out and collected drinking water samples and also worked with the Department of Public Health to do a biomonitoring component. And so what they did is they developed a questionnaire that sort of tried to capture any other exposures that might have happened, occupational exposures, food histories, things like that. And so they collected urine specimens. This is part of the whole collaboration thing. They worked with the Department of Public Health, as I said, to develop a study design, to get IRB approval, to recruit participants. They didn't have enough. They couldn't do all of the drinking water participants. So they used the questionnaire to try to figure out who would be at the highest risk of exposure. Do I have 1 minute?
No.
Oh, gosh. Okay. And so going through the process of what happens during a biomonitoring study, the first step was they had to identify what biomarker to use. Well, urine made the most sense because both arsenic and uranium are easily measured in urine. It's non-invasive, you know. I mean, you don't have to poke somebody with a needle. I don't think it's a 24-hour collection, so you don't need to collect their urine over 24 hours. And so they thought that would allow for a greater participation rate. Luckily, it's a validated method because Massachusetts is part of this laboratory response network. They actually have a really good relationship with CDC, and they had validated methods in urine for both of these, and it's very scientifically accepted. So they had the equipment available. It's important to think about that. The equipment, they needed to consider how accurate and precise the method would be, what its limits of detection were. If its limit of detection is higher than what you expect to find in the population, you have a problem because you're going to find everybody below the limit of detection. So there's lots of considerations from the laboratory perspective. They wanted the method to be robust and rugged. And they wanted it to be generally accepted by the scientific community. And also, you have to think about, how many samples can you do per day? How long does it take to do the method? How many samples are there? How many people are you going to have working on this? So they went with their ICP-MS, stands for Inductively Coupled Plasma Mass Spectrometry. Very fun, exciting instrument. When I did my graduate work in Albany, I really wanted to use this instrument, but because I was on the lowest end of the totem pole, I got stuck with something much older and much more clunky. But the cool thing about ICP-MS is you can do multiple metals at a time. So they were able to do both of these at the same time. And it's very sensitive, and they could also speciate using this. Now, speciate is important because there's certain forms of these elements that are more toxic than others. And so if you find high levels in someone, you want to go and do the next step and speciate to find out, are they high levels of the bad form? And they actually, Massachusetts did find, I think 20 out of 100 people did have elevated levels of arsenic. And they did, they went back and they speciated. I don't think those results have been published yet. I think they're still under review. And I think also the Department of Public Health up there is still working to communicate the results with the participants, which is a very important part of any biomonitoring study. So the laboratory infrastructure is important. Do you have the space? Do you have the security? You know, not only do you need to make sure that the patient's samples are safe, but you need to make sure that the data on the patients is going to be protected. What happens if the equipment is needed for something like a sulfur mustard exposure? You know, do you have redundant equipment? Or if it goes down, what do you do? Do you have people who are trained in this method? You know, do you have people who know what to do and how to do it and who are also trained on data privacy? And then information technology. Oh, what a headache. I won't even go into this, but can you handle the data and the information at the laboratory? Believe it or not, there's a lot of issues with that. Here's CLIA to my CLIA questioner. It's very important to have CLIA certification, and you have to, anytime you're going to do a biomonitoring study, that's an important consideration. It has certain minimum standards and guidelines, and it's required if test results might be used for diagnostic purposes. Even if you don't plan to use the results for diagnostic purposes, if you just plan to analyze them for research, they still could possibly be used for diagnostic purposes, and you need CLIA certification. So then the next step is thinking about specimen collection, and actually the laboratorians help train the people who are going out into the field and collecting samples because they want to make sure that they use the right collection tube or the right collection cup and that they do it in a way that's not going to contaminate the sample. So they work with the epidemiologists in the Department of Public Health to write up a written protocol, they also lot test materials. So say you have like a bunch of tubes that you're going to go out and collect these samples in. You want to make sure the tubes don't have arsenic or uranium in them already. Metals are around us everywhere, and so you need to test the materials to make sure that there's no background contamination. And you also want the people out in the field to collect blanks, to collect samples that aren't from, you know, people, but are just from that general environment to see if that environment had contamination. And you also have to think about handling and transporting the samples. Do you put them in a fridge until the end of the day after they've been collected? How long can they stay in the fridge? What temperature do they need to be at? Do you transport them on dry ice, or, you know, all of these different considerations? And chain of custody is important too. If anything legal ever comes up, if anybody ever challenges your results, and this happens, laboratories have to go and testify. You need to be able to show who touched the sample when, where it was at all times in the process. Thank you. Quality assurance is a very important laboratory consideration, and you need to have a formalized quality assurance plan. Within biomonitoring, there's specific challenges. There's lots of things we can biomonitor for, but you need to have standards. You need to have a vial of something that you can buy that you can say, okay, this concentration is a known concentration, so you can compare your unknown concentration to known concentrations. So the availability of standards is a really important consideration when you're doing a biomonitoring study. Matrix matched quality control materials, that's when it's an actual blood sample that's been spiked with a known concentration. Just to see if there's anything else in the blood that might interfere with the method. Proficiency testing is a very important laboratory consideration. So a lot of laboratories do this. There's two programs out there. The Center de Toxicology, I don't speak French, Toxicology, I'm going to say, in Quebec. And Wadsworth Center both have some proficiency testing programs. But it's basically, it's sort of a test that you do to make sure, you know, somebody sends you a sample, you analyze it, and then you send back your results, and they make sure that you got what you were supposed to get. Reflex testing is very important, and I did talk about this a little bit. So anybody who had a high concentration had to get retested to make sure there wasn't something wrong, that this wasn't just a fluke. You know, you don't want to report a result and maybe scare somebody unless you're absolutely sure of it. So reflex testing means anything above a certain level, you go back and you retest. And in this case, they also speciated when they retested. Normalizing data is very important. There's a lot of advocacy groups out there who do biomonitoring testing. They'll go and they'll say, we tested our state legislature to see what they're exposed to or something like that to raise awareness. But there's a lot of these considerations that really need to be part of it, and sometimes these don't always happen. So part of our hope is to help better design studies. You need to correct for things when you think about it. Non-fasting samples, you don't have high lipids when you're fasting. And lipids can interfere with some of your measurements. So in some cases, you need to correct for lipids. And the same with urine samples. Data interpretation is very important. I mentioned limits of detection. And if all your results are below the limit of detection, you have a problem. But how to interpret the data? Laboratorians are a key part of that process. It's challenging with biomonitoring because a lot of things we don't know. We don't know what the background level is. We don't know what a high level is. And if we do say you're higher than background, does that mean that your health is impacted? You know, no, it doesn't. You know, so we're measuring these things, and we need to communicate the results back to people. But we don't often have really good answers for some of their basic questions. Thank you. So reporting results, I think this is the last slide. So the purpose of the study dictates how the results will be reported. So an emergency response, you have to make decisions. You know, usually an emergency response, you want to know, should we evacuate a building? Should we decontaminate people? You know, so it's really important to be able to report results in real time. Targeted and surveillance efforts, not as much. You have a lot more time to sort of review things and figure out a way to communicate the results. Panic values are, you know, you find something that you know is bad for folks, say mercury, and you find it at a really high level. You do a reflex test, you find it's still at that same high level. You want to get to that patient quickly and let them know, or their doctor or physician, and let them know that there's something wrong. Usually the laboratory is not usually the one who ever will talk to a patient. It always goes through a medical professional, although HHS just recently proposed changes to the rule that they're now proposing that patients will be able to access their laboratory records themselves. So that might change. I think that's it.
That is.
Thank you very much.
All right.
On behalf of Julie.
On behalf of Julie, exactly. Would you mind saying something else?